Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. Today I have the pleasure of being with Sam Froggatt. He is a golf gadget guru, and we're actually in his facility, which we'll find out here more about. So this is a in-person interview, not one I typically do over the web. He is the CEO of iLine Golf, a company that specializes in creating and selling training aids for anyone to improve their golf game and golf play. Their training products are used by weekend leisure golfers as well as hundreds of PGA players. Sam's route to becoming a product innovator in the golf industry started in sales and marketing at IBM, and then as an independent sales rep for golf equipment. Sam, thanks for talking today with us about product development and the products you've come up with.
My pleasure. I don't think I've ever had anybody interview me about how the products come about. They interview me about the products, but not the process.
Very good. Glad we can be the first.
Sure. So,
and where are we? I know we're sitting on this... It's kind of a loft space in an office building in Monument, Colorado. It has a gorgeous view of the Front Range. We can see Pikes Peak. Kind of a nice, inspiring design location. But this is not headquarters, is it?
No, this is... We have two locations. They're about 150 miles apart. The other location has the warehouse, is the rest of the business. It's the warehouse and all the technical stuff and all the support staff is there. I have an office here because I lived here all my life. And... this particular office thing that you're in with this loft, I know it sounds crazy, but I needed a room that was tall enough that I could swing a golf club. And so I found the top floor of this building that had a lofted ceiling, which I could do that. The other benefit, and I think it's important, is that you mentioned the view. For me, being creative is all about light, and it's about seeing things that are inspiring. I love to watch the weather pattern. It's just fun for me. Mm-hmm. So I've been in this building a long time and finally managed to move my way until this was available. And then we popped up here as soon as we could. So it was, it's an important space for me. I love coming here, which I think is important to be able to create and for me, spread stuff out all over the place. And you know that by looking at the floors most of the time.
I can attest to that. And I'm sitting on artificial green turf. So a good design space that helps you be creative.
It's fantastic. You got to have it.
Very good. So let's talk about your background a little bit. Those years at IBM doing sales and marketing, and then in the golf industry selling golf equipment, did that lead up to prepare you for developing golf products? Did that help you in some sense?
You know, IBM was always a great experience for me. I learned systems. I learned big business and that sort of thing. I don't think that was the pivotal part of innovative. I will tell you that when I was a kid growing up, didn't come from a big wealthy background. So if I wanted golf lessons, there was a guy at the public course that I begged him to be able to wash his car or do anything I could to get a golf lesson. And he said, I will do that under one condition. You will spend three afternoons a week on the, what do you call the short game area where you hit putts or chips or bunker shots or very short shots. But you have to spend three afternoons a week there. Well, frankly, it's a little lonely. And so I would do it for sure. But I made up countless games, scenarios, tournaments that I was playing. I'm making it all up as I go. Hmm. Well, in the process of that, you kind of spawn your creative juices. But at the same time, you think this would be a lot more fun if I had a target circle that I could chip a ball into or hit it. Or if I had some way to keep score, whatever. I think that summer was the spawning ground for almost everything we do now. That and the fact that I have two sons that played competitively, and I was trying to play on the senior tour, and we were constantly trying to find new ways to practice. And that's where the whole system came from in the beginning, is that I could not find a product, in that case, to help us with alignment anywhere in the world. That's all I wanted. I didn't want to build a business. I just wanted to find something that would help me. And I think those were the turning points more than anything else.
So two key pivotal moments.
Huge.
The first was, sounds like a Karate Kid experience, right? Where you were learning to wax on and wax off.
I've never thought of about it like that, but that is almost exactly right.
Mm-hmm. How old were you then?
I couldn't drive, so I must have been 14 or 15.
Yeah, so you were young.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the second pivotal experience was wanting to develop a tool for you and your sons to just get better.
Absolutely. And I think, we get the opportunity now. We've brought out 60 products or so in the last dozen years. And we get the opportunity now to talk to a lot of people who have ideas for products. And there's two trains of thought. One is I created this because I wanted to get better. Mm-hmm. And what comes from that is a real committed sense of ownership and fun and excitement because I'm just trying to get better. The other phone calls I get are people that want to develop a product because they want a product to sell. I'm trying to find a great idea that'll make me a lot of money and mm-hmm. let me retire. Those are tremendously divergent points of view. The products that are successful with us are products that are emotionally owned by someone, usually us, but someone, as opposed to, I want to create something that will make me a lot of money. For us, that doesn't, it never flies.
Hmm. So let's talk more about where those ideas come from then.
Okay.
Where do you get the ideas for products? You just shared sometimes it sounds like it's through a phone call to someone else.
It doesn't happen very often, Chad. Okay. I would have to look specifically, but I think we probably have 10 products that 10 products that have come to us from someone else. But typically how that comes to us is someone will call and they will say, for instance, I can give you an example. We have something called a pendulum putting rod. There was an assistant pro in Tennessee, I think. And he called and he said, I've got an idea for a product. Basically, it will attach to the putter and it will extend to a player's sternum. He said, right now it's a dowel rod that I use and I put some tape on either end to fit the student. But it really tends to help him. And Chad, instantly on the phone, I could see this product. I knew it would work. Mm-hmm. It solved a problem that I knew existed. Obviously, it's not a stick. It's an aluminum rod that extends and can adjust, etc. But that was the idea. And that's as in depth as his idea, as much as he interacted with the development of it, was that idea. That's a rare one. But it's typically some problem that comes up that we want to solve, as opposed to I have a product I want to create. It's always what problem are we solving mm-hmm. and how do we solve it? Is it a complicated solution or is it a simple solution? We're all about simple.
Okay. How else do you encounter these problems? Besides, mostly it's not people calling. It sounds like a lot of experience you've had here.
Yeah. It's a great question because in any industry or anybody that focuses on industry, you have a gut reaction from years of experience or your own personal things that have happened. So we've got a lot of people that interact with their own game, which is critical. We focus a lot on PGA instructors that are interacting with students all the time, thousands and millions of students. I am on the PGA. I'm on all the professional tours enough to what I call spot trends. Those guys are searching for the fraction of a stroke. And I pay a lot of attention if I see certain ideas. I mean, they go to Home Depot too. They're taping stuff together. So I'm paying them a lot of attention. And then on the edge of the putting green, which is where we typically live, I'll talk to their instructors. What are you working on? What are you trying to solve? What's important? What things are you seeing? And I'll try to interpret that. Sometimes it just falls into a product. Sometimes it's too complex for us. It's not, we're not technical in nature. We're pretty, hard goods oriented. Mm-hmm. So the ideas come from that. And our own play. I refuel my tanks by playing. So if I'm working on something in my own game, it's a pretty good sign. I'm not the only person around that's trying that.
So are you just playing all the time now? I mean, as I hear you say that you refill your own tanks, I'm just wondering, is this like the dream job that you get to?
Oh, there's no question. It's the dream job of all dream jobs. I mean, it's not.
I'm sure there's some golfers listening that are pretty jealous.
Yeah, it's not fair. There's so few people that get to do exactly what they want. And I get to, and I don't get to play as much as I'd like. But I putt a lot. I mean, obviously, we're here in the putting studio.
I'm not sure if I know a golfer that does get to play as much as they like.
But here in the studio, we call it, You know, there isn't a day that I don't putt for a while. Mm-hmm. And we talk about it and we think about it and we, you know, that's what we do. And it's, the ideas come from, this is a problem. I'm not being able to do this right and I want to get better. So it's fun.
So let me break that down just a little bit, make sure I got that clear for everyone listening too. So it's a lot of time actually out on the tour with the professionals. Yeah. So in terms of market segments, you're across the spectrum here. So you target the PGA players, but also it's the weekend amateur person. But do your ideas, do you focus on the pros and how, if is the thinking that if I can help them get better, then obviously anyone playing golf I can help get better?
That is exactly right.
Okay.
Exactly. If it gets reversed, if I'm trying to build something for the weekend guy, tour player, they may or may not be able to use it, but most likely cannot. And it doesn't hold any credibility. It certainly is not global. I mean, we sell products all around the planet. Tour players or the most credible people in the market, if they use it, they, even by use without saying, hey, this is great, the fact that they're using it and we don't pay anybody to use anything, that lets the world know this is a legitimate product. If that's the case, it'll filter down to the average guy.
Okay.
And then that's up to us to be able to interpret the use of it. We always say that the product has two features. One is the physical product. The other is the instruction that goes with it. So we are the ones who distill perhaps complex information and make it simple. That's the second part of the product.
Okay. And in terms of innovation management, we might call them lead users. They're on the forefront of becoming, they're already the best.
Yep.
And they're trying to get better.
Yeah. And they're the innovators before the early adopters. Mm-hmm. And their coaches, their instructors are, if there was a segment before that, that would be their coaches. Because they're thinking about problems all the time. And they don't necessarily have a creative mind to come up with a product, but they are a incredible creative mind to analyze the problem and what are we trying to solve here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we get so many calls from teachers saying, I got an idea, or what are you doing for this, or how about that? So.
Okay. So you're actually out in person on the tour, people playing, people practicing. Mm-hmm. So you're getting face-to-face feedback from the players, from their caddies, from their coaches.
Yep.
Sounds like.
Absolutely.
Okay. And that's where the ideas come from.
It's that. And I think the other part is, while we do golf products, we are trainers first. If you were to look at it that way, we are helping people learn. So our study, my reading, my study techniques, is very little about golf. It's a lot about how does the mind work? Hmm. How do people learn? How do you say it in a certain way? How do they process information? How do they build motion, you know, that's golf is a motion. How do I build a consistent motion? So that's what I study. Mm-hmm. And therefore the products that we develop typically have to fall within the guidelines of this is how people learn. And therefore this product makes sense. Or this is how people learn. This product is goofy. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. And there's something else you said earlier that I've heard frequently, which is the importance of trends.
Yeah,
as you're out there listening, you're trying to pick up on the growing trends, right? You know, everyone this year is having some problem with, ABC. I don't know what that would be in golf, right?
Yeah.
And that might be an opportunity then to look at a solution for that.
Well, yes. And those trends typically come from something else. So in golf, like everything else, technology is a big deal. And these instructors, they have the highest grades of technology, but it still boils down to a simple movement. You still, no matter what the technology tells you, it's not making you move. So through their technology, they've identified a problem that the naked eye can't see. Mm-hmm. That's what I solve. Mm. Here's the problem. You just need to get the putter face aimed in a certain way, or this relationship, or this whatever. That's where I come in. So that's why the trending out there is so important to me, is that they distill the technology information, and then I get to come back in and create something that help people turn that into a simple movement.
Okay. Do you also ever get insights on trends that are decreasing, things that you want to
absolutely
get out of that area?
Absolutely. And the reason is, frankly, a lot of times the technology has disavowed some preconceived assumption that it could have been there for 100 years. But it's, you know what? We found out that's not true anymore. And we watch it just literally go away. And there are fads that pop up as well. And part of our, you know, we would like our life cycle to be pretty long with products. We don't, and they have been. But that's because they're built on principle, not on fad. And it's not terribly difficult to figure that out. The infomercial product you see that's the latest kitchen knife is not a, no, that's not a future trend. That's a fad that pops up and goes away. We're not, that's not our deal.
Right. So it sounds like the real keys to understanding the problem here for you has been, you know, personal experience with the industry.
Absolutely.
You know, you were selling equipment before, you play golf.
Right.
And then spending a lot of time on the tour with the lead users, the best players, their coaches, their caddies.
Yep.
And really knowing what their problems are.
Yeah, that's where it starts.
Okay, good. Then what are the characteristics like of a successful product?
Okay. So we had three principles that we've used since day one. The first thing is what we call it has to be fundamentally sound. It means it's not built on, it's kind of goes back to that fad idea almost, but it has to be fundamental. It has to do the right things. If I start on a false assumption, then no matter what I do is going to be incorrect. Chad, half the phone calls we get on people with new product ideas are built on faulty assumptions. And if you've been around the industry at all, you would go, that doesn't even make sense. Although what you're saying is true, it's wrong, right? To you, it's, yeah, this will function like that. It's just not true. It doesn't work. So that's number one. The second thing is it's got to be what we call simple or what we call intuitive. Mm-hmm. So what we've learned from marketing is if I have a product, even if it works, but it's not intuitive, someone has to explain it to me. We don't have the resources to sell that product because it takes forever. I mean, there's no word of mouth. You have to demo it to someone to do it. That's not smart business. Mm-hmm. There's too many other products that are intuitive. So we pay a lot of attention to that. Is this intuitive? When we throw down a putting mirror, there's no confusion. I mean, it's a mirror. I get it. There's lines on it. I can probably figure that out. So that's an easy product to sell because we don't have to explain it. We have made some colossal mistakes with products that are awesome and they're not intuitive and they just lay there. So that's bad. The third thing is it has to be unembarrassing. I don't think that's a word, but it gets the point about everybody has probably seen some golf movie where somebody's got gadgets hanging off of them or tin cup and all sorts of weird stuff. Mm-hmm. Those are embarrassing. So we create products that are unembarrassing that if it's too complicated or it's too embarrassing to use, you won't use it. Therefore, the story stops. You know, one of our marketing tenets is our deal is we equip people to tell the story. So if you've got a product that's fun, it looks like you're having a good time. Golf is not typically played in a bubble. There's other people around watching. If it looks like you're having a good time with it and you can tell the story of what it is and what it does, then that is our marketing. Mm-hmm. So if it's unembarrassing and you're free to use it a lot, then you can tell the story. That's how products really gain traction. So those are three things.
Yeah. So key things there, keeping it simple. It actually solves a real problem.
Yes.
What was your second one?
Well, the first one is it has to be fundamentally sound. It has to really work. The second one is it has to be simple or intuitive. Mm-hmm. The third one is it has to be unembarrassing.
Looking at some of your past products and doing research for the interview, I found photos of pro golfers, you know, with a putting mirror on the ground next to them.
Yeah.
And I read about one golfer who had his bag modified with a sleeve for the putting mirror to go in.
Yeah.
So these are products that, you know, they're not embarrassed by clearly. They're out using them.
Yeah, and that's obviously from a marketing standpoint, going to that point, we have been very fortunate. You know, it's an overnight success, except that it took 12 years for the overnight success to happen. But when a certain player that has the platform, so to speak, of the industry says, hey, I'm playing better because I'm putting better. I'm putting better because of this mirror. That will change a small business in a heartbeat. But you don't get that credibility because you pay somebody to say it. It's got to be because they use it. And that's, you know, it took a long time to get there. That's shown up on a lot of putting greens around the world for a decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good viral marketing among the pros.
Before viral was even
exactly.
Yeah.
So let's walk through a specific example, because I want to get the full picture here of, you know, how you came up with an idea for a product,
okay.
How, you know, you maybe tested that concept, built a prototype, got feedback, you know, got it actually manufactured, you know, and give it to players to use. So pick an example for us of a real product,
okay.
And walk us through that, Joseph.
Let me just walk you through, because it's fascinating to me as you ask me these questions. My brain jumps back a long time ago, but one of the first putting products that we did was because I was trying to find a way for me and the boys to use a mirror to check certain things in our putting alignment. You know, you look down in a mirror, you see your face, there's a line on whatever. There was not a mirror out there. So what you typically do is you go find a mirror, which is, you know, at the Home Depot. They're thick glass, they're sharp, they're dangerous, but depends on how much you want to get better. You can't cut glass, or I can't cut glass. And that's where it starts. And you test the concept with that very crude, dangerous piece of equipment, which you can't take to the golf course. So the lab that I have is a putting green in my basement that I constructed out of 2x4s and plywood and carpet. And you go there and then you say, you know what, this seems to work, but I need to be able to make it a little bit closer to reality. So in that case, I found a company nearby that sold acrylic mirrors for prisons, right? So there, and I found it in a 4x8 sheet, 4 feet by 8 foot sheet. And of course, I needed 18 inches by 9 inches. So I still have most of that sheet of acrylic left if anybody wants to have that. But I could cut it, and I could cut it with a jigsaw, and I could cut it to shape, and that's where it started. And then we started testing it, and I would draw lines on it, or I would use tape to draw lines on it until we got it a little bit closer. But once we used it a lot, fortunately with me, I was playing a lot. I would take it with me. People would ask me questions. I would ask them questions, which we still do to this day, kind of field test it to say, what are you looking at? What's important about this? And you watch people as they use it in a different way than I ever conceived of it. And that's how it all started. And then eventually you find, for us, the domestic manufacturer that can make the quality better in acrylic, because obviously that was better than glass, and make it cooler. And in this case, I found, and this is kind of a big lesson, I found a company that made acrylic mirror license plates. And that was the size of our first mirror because I could get it.
That was the size they made.
That's the size they made, and that's the size that was perfect for us all of a sudden. And we used that for a while, and then we found the company. Then the company that made the acrylic license plates, we contracted with them to make one specifically to our specs. And that's 75 or 100,000 of those mirrors later is where we sit now.
Wow. Okay, so steps in there. You had a need in the first place.
Yep.
In this case, it was a personal need.
Absolutely.
You probably have stories of the same thing, that it came from a player.
Yep.
You know, KB.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
And then you went to work with your Home Depot and your yep. little lab in the basement mm-hmm. and create a rough prototype,
mm-hmm.
something that just is good enough to mm-hmm. start testing.
Mm-hmm.
And you took it out in the field and tested it,
mm-hmm.
and other people took notice,
mm-hmm.
and you might ask them questions, and they give you feedback, and they try it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then you iterate on this a little bit, right? You take mm-hmm. it back home, you refine it,
mm-hmm.
you find out what needs to get modified,
Absolutely.
Add to it. Until finally you get to a point where you're feeling like this is the right thing, right?
I think, honestly, in today's terms, you might say it's good enough,
mm-hmm.
is that's the term. We have never ever created a product and brought it to the market that it was finished. It is. We always think it's finished. It's never finished.
You always get other feedback
it's
that tells you
always,
things.
It always has a tweak. It can be size. I mean, we've done products where literally when it was finished, it was a half an inch too long for a box to ship it in off the shelf. Well, the next iteration that we do, it's going to be a half an inch shorter,
mm-hmm.
right? Because those boxes are expensive. If all you have to do is make the product a half an inch smaller. Now, that's not for everybody, but you do after, if you've done it enough, you think in terms of that. How are we going to ship this? How do we pack it? Especially with today's shipping cost, that's a big question. And if I can modify that at the beginning, I'll do it. And one of the things that we were blessed with early on, Chad, was for whatever reason, pretty locally, we probably got connected to maybe four or five vendors that were also starting their companies. A plastics guy, a sheet metal fabricator, a powder coater guy. It was amazing. They were starting their business. We were starting our business. I mean, we didn't know each other, but we became friends. And when I needed something done, they would jump through hoops for me. And I would go in my ignorance without an engineering background with a golf ball sometimes and say, it's got to be this wide or it has to be. Here's a putter and here's a thing and it has to fit this. They would look at me and kind of laugh because they were looking for business and I was looking for help. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important concept in innovation at our level is they weren't, I mean, maybe all those people could be in a single company and you could go to them, you know, walk around the office and find them. But for me to find them locally was a big deal. And I would literally go face to face with them and say, in 15 minutes, we would knock out something that, you know, if I was trying to send them drawings or something, might take weeks or months. Mm. So that was a big deal. I still work with them. I still, to this day, they're still our partners.
Yeah. So I think the bigger story there is having that network of people that you know you can count on.
Yeah.
But actually help you with the manufacturing process too.
And the other part with that, by the way, I am always careful to take them back the finished product because they never get to see one, right? They're extruding an aluminum rail. They've never seen the product. So when I take them back a photo of that aluminum rail, it's been powder coated and screen printed and the attachments put on it, et cetera, and there's a tour player using this at a PGA Tour event, they are ecstatic because now their step is a part of this really cool finished project. And that's a principle that we apply all the time because we like the same thing. We want to see people using our stuff too. So that's a big deal. Creating passion on a team is, I can't even talk about how important that is.
Sure. And even though it's not your employees, team, it's the partners you work with.
It's a teammate. Done. It's very much a teammate. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a Christmas card, you know, kind of a deal.
Right. And you're letting them know that the work they're doing, how it contributes to the bigger picture, and it's really important to make this thing real.
Yeah.
And now it's being out and used by someone on the tour.
You did something really fun. Mm-hmm. And look at this. And they just light up. And it's really fun sometimes to go back to those companies because they're small companies typically, and they have a display case. And to see our products in their display case, it's not because our products are complex. It's that this is cool. This is fun. I want to show this off to other customers that we might have.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And for the everyday innovators listening, I think there's a really important lesson here because often inside companies, we get really busy on our projects and we're all typically behind schedule when it comes to getting them finished in the first place.
Yeah.
And then we have to move on to the next one. We don't take time to celebrate the success
and
let everyone know on the team that contributed what the final product actually was.
Absolutely. So. And I think the other part is it's just, you can't separate the emotional connection to the creative mind. If I'm emotionally connected to what I'm doing, I'm more creative. Mm-hmm. So are they. So are my vendors. Because they know more about plastics and metal than I ever will. And if they are emotionally connected to the project, they'll go, you know what would be cool? If we could do this or that, I think I can do that. Mm. Well, I know nothing of that.
Right.
But if it's just me on the phone sending them a PO to print this, we're not emotionally connected.
Right. Yep. They have a context for how their work matters and they can add their expertise to it.
And their people just light up. Because typically when I go to our plastics manufacturer, for instance, he's not working on it directly. He's got people that are doing it. They're just giddy about the whole thing. The next time I come in with a laser, I have a huddle of people going, what's that? What's that? What are we going to do with this? Mm-hmm. How do we do that? So
awesome. Good. And I'm sure these aren't all golfers, right?
None of them are golfers. Right? That's the best part. Yeah, you're right.
They're just glad to see something.
There's typically one guy or one woman, it's in one case, that are, and they've been waiting for somebody to listen to them anyway, and they just bubble up. It's like, and I make sure that I get them a free whatever it is we're doing. Mm-hmm. Because they're the ambassador within those four walls. Because eventually, I'm going to need a favor.
There you go.
I know I am.
The ability to influence without any real authority.
Yep.
Right. It's important to develop.
Good.
Good. So the business has been successful. You've learned lots of good lessons about mm-hmm. product development, product management, mm-hmm. Lots of creativity mm-hmm. along the way, and lots of goodwill, right? You're just a delightful person to talk to. And every time I've had interactions with you, you know, I always just walk away feeling good. And I'm wondering what you would tell someone who is starting out in this world of product development management, regardless of the industry, whatever they're making, right? Someone who is new to product development, what advice you would give them that, you know, something you wish you would have known then that you know now and you practice now?
Boy, that's golden. I do think that keeping an eye on trends is important. And the reason is I have an idea. I want to develop it. By the time I can take that from my brain to the market, the market's moved. And I had a friend of mine a long time ago say the best rule of marketing that I know is to figure out where the market's going and get in front of it, mm-hmm. let it run over you, as opposed to try to push a market a certain way. So trying to spot trends is a big deal. I'm a huge reader of books. They're not golf books. None of them are golf books. I don't think I've read a golf book ever. But there are great books and audiobooks, et cetera, on innovation, case studies, things like that, because ultimately a great product has to connect the dots in a different way to solve a problem, usually. And those dots are not typically lined up straight. You know, the stories that inspire me even today, this morning, are about, I was reading something this morning about a guy who, he started with origami, and you laugh, but it taught him patterns of thinking and development and so forth. And you think, what does that have to do with golf? It has everything to do with golf. It has to do with, you know what? If I put this together with that, typically my ideas are a compilation of two or three mediocre ideas mm-hmm. that when put together turn into a pretty good product. So I would say that would be a huge part about innovation. The other thing is and we kind of follow these guidelines. We try to say, what problem are you solving? How much is it worth to someone to solve that problem? Because that is what sets the price tag for the problem that you're going to solve it with. My example of that is that I had a guy come by a merchandise show, and he says, I've got a new product that will solve the problem of people moving their heads. Well, moving your heads in golf is a problem. So he had my attention. He was an engineer, and he had developed a laser or something, but the laser was $300 or $400 it was going to be. Well, the first step was find a problem you can solve, which he did. The second step was how much are people willing to pay to solve that problem? They're never going to spend $400 on that. So that problem went away. So what we say is solve the problem. How much will people pay to solve it? And then can you create and manufacture something that fits within that cost guideline? There have been plenty of great ideas that I cannot find a product solution to fit within what I think someone would be willing to pay.
Right.
Plenty of those. And then there have been a few that I've found new ways to go back that maybe that product idea was in the drawer for 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And now I can just clear as day say, you know what? If we had this, we drilled holes in that, we put a magnet here, had a laser attachment to that, that would be perfect. That wasn't on the board 4 years ago in my brain. So I think that's the idea.
Not only that, you know, so over the time the pieces came together, but also the technology changes.
Absolutely.
And you have access to new solutions.
Absolutely. And so to that point, I think it's important to stay involved with the technology. For us, you know, 3D printing is all of a sudden available. That wasn't available 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But your brain has to be engaged with what's going on. So I think you stay in touch with as much current new literature as you can to try to spark creativity. And you got to keep yourself refreshed. I think if you ever get tired to the point that you're not creative, or you're worn out, or your thinking gets stale. And I'll tell you the other thing, Chad, when you're under huge financial stress, you're not a very creative person, not in a good way, not in product innovation. Mm-hmm. You can be creative in ways to whatever, but I think that's important to recognize. We get calls occasionally from guys that say, hey, I've got a product. I've got a huge financial burden. I just need to sell the idea. And I was hoping you could just buy it and make me rich and solve my problems. Well, typically those are not very good ideas, frankly. because they're not born out of a need to solve a problem for anybody but themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's not, I empathize with those guys and I'll listen every time. And if there's anything I can do to help them, I will. But that's never worked for us. You know, when there's financial stress, I'm not a creative person that way. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of financial stress, but not from a product innovation standpoint.
Yeah, real good. So a lot of good insights. Thank you for emphasizing the importance of trends there. Mm-hmm. And dealing with real world constraints, right? Making a product that you can sell at a price point people will pay and mm-hmm. a margin that makes sense for the company.
Right? Well, and the price point could be $10 million.
It all depends on the customer.
Yeah, right? It depends on what you're solving. For us, the price point could be $10 or it could be $30 or $100, mm-hmm. but there is a logical decision. And it's always funny. One of the things I get from people is I'll ask them during the course. I said, how much do you think people would pay to solve this problem? Half the time they'll say, it doesn't make any difference. They'll pay any amount of money to solve this problem. To which I say, are you sure? Because I'm not going to pay, right?
Right.
But I'm so in love with my baby that I think everybody else will be in love with it too. They're not.
Yeah. Yeah. And the reality is,
I think your baby's ugly.
We never really know until someone pulls out their wallet and hands those dollars over.
I know that person.
And that's when you.
I know that person.
Now you know what the value is, yep, when someone's paid the money.
I know the person was the first person who handed me $30 for our first putting mirror. I know that guy's name. I know him. I can see his face. And it gives me chills to talk about it now because that's the point. He was a stranger. It's not your friends.
Right.
Your friends are not a good barometer if you have a good product. They are not good at it. You have to walk up to a complete stranger who doesn't know you, and the guy or gal looks at it and says, how much is this? $30. Here's my $30. Now you know it's legit. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, I think people would pay that. Nope. You got to give me the money.
Right. Yeah, and that's when you know. Good. Lots of great lessons there. I always like to ask my guests, what's a favorite innovation or success quote and why you chose that?
Whoa. Those are, as much as I read and stuff, I'm constantly fused. I have a couple of principles that I work with that are quotes. I'm kind of a scripture guy. Mm-hmm. I think there's two things, and they seem in conflict almost. One is be still and know that I'm God. The key is the stillness of it. I've got to find time during my day to be still. And that's, by the way, that is a trend. Whether it's from a spiritual perspective or any business leadership book you read now, some time during the day to be still and let the snow globe settle a bit. And it's not email, it's not Twitter, it's not. I have to be able to let my brain begin to connect dots. If I'm constantly on the move, I can't mm-hmm. do it. I just can't. I can never be still. I can't close my eyes and see a blank canvas. I see a mess. Mm-hmm. The other one is, in the multitude of counsel, there's wisdom. That can't be emphasized enough because I've got a good idea, but it's inside my head and I only see it through my filter. I need a lot of people looking at this. And wherever that may be, I need a lot of people going, well, why is that there? That's too far away. Or boy, that's really hard. Or this is too easy. Or the reflection is too bright in my eyes. Well, that's a lot of people that I need to look at and say, you're not the only person who's going to think that. I need to adapt this perhaps, or with all due respect, you don't know what you're talking about. I think I can get around that. But both of those things are critical as a daily habit and as a product development. If you're going to do something worthwhile, it's got to be your best stuff. And then you get it out there and then you're going to continue to refine it. But you got to listen.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And you said those were both scripture references.
Right.
And listeners, I'll put in the show notes for this the references to the,
sure,
the verses for those. So what do you want to leave listeners with, and just how, if they want to follow what's going on with Eyeline Golf and the work you're doing, how can we do that?
You know, probably the best place is our website. It's eyelinegolf.com, EYELINEGOLF.com. Because, you know, we don't have any paper anymore. We're not printing catalogs. But if you go on there, typically you're going to see new innovations. You're going to see photos and quotes from tour players, et cetera. And that's really, you know, we introduce 5 to 7 new products a year, basically. At any one time, we've probably got a dozen products on the board that we're fiddling with in one phase or another. So I think that's the best way to kind of stay in touch with us. You can send me an email anytime at sam@islandgolf.com. I love to hear from anybody. It strengthens me. It energizes me. And I can, you know, I was that guy that was trying to find somebody to license our product. And so those are typically the calls or emails I get. That didn't work out for us. But the guts to make that call was big on my part to make those calls. So when I get that call from somebody, I honor that courage that it took. I have never not talked to somebody about a product idea for that reason. Mm-hmm. It's in my gut that, you know, if you're courageous enough to try this, you need to be honored enough to get some feedback. It doesn't happen that it's our product very often. Maybe never. At that level, the teachers are probably a better source. But, you know, the idea that you're passionate enough about something to overcome the fear barrier to do it, that's a big deal. We mm-hmm. need people like that.
Yeah, very good. Wonderful information, Sam. I really appreciate your time. I do want to just wrap up for the listeners, because I'm going to do another episode on how do we prepare the next generation for innovation, to create the future generation of innovation leaders. And so that will be coming. But real quickly, I had the pleasure of helping to teach a group of 9 to 12-year-olds about innovation topics and how the topics involved robotics and 3D design and communication skills. And this is how Sam and I encountered each other, was he was talking about the need to prototype a little, you know, basically a little coupler that let two pieces of plastic slide through it. And I mentioned that I had this group of kids that was doing 3D design and printing 3D objects out in a 3D printer. And we actually had the kids independently come up with concepts, and they came up with 4 different prototype concepts, and we evolved those. And one is going out on the tour soon, isn't it?
It will be introduced in mass at the U.S. Open in another month.
That's pretty exciting for us. So,
it's exciting for me too. You solved a problem that had me stumped.
So, everyday innovators, be thinking about that. What can you do to help encourage the next generation of to be innovators themselves and to lead us into the future? So, thank you very much for listening again. If you find value in this, please go out to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. You will get them automatically every week then in your iTunes feed. Or just come to the website, theeverydayinnovator.com. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.